Podcast.
Listen to The Organist, the culturally omnivorous, intellectually ravenous podcast from the editors of The Believer magazine.
Part of poetry is learning how to speak.
Chilly Billy, Chilly Billy.
I am also a horse.
I really value my life, even though I know it's debatable whether I'm even really alive.
The right reading for this is the one I'm giving it.
Find The Organist on KCRW.com or wherever you download podcasts.
From KCRW in Santa Monica and PRI, Public Radio International, this is To the Point.
Will Rio be ready? I'm Barbara Bogave, sitting in for Warren Olney, and this is To the Point from Public Radio International. Just 4 weeks before hosting the Olympic Games, and Brazil is in a state of emergency. The government racked by corruption, the economy failing. In Rio, at least one structure has collapsed with fatal consequences. Other venues are nowhere near completion, and the water is so polluted with superbacteria, the U.S. rowing team will wear special sewage-proof suits. Can Rio really pull off hosting these games? Is Brazil's Olympic run-up the most crisis-riddled ever, or just business as usual? We'll preview the athletes to watch if they show up. And on today's Talking Point, the deadliest attack in Baghdad since 2003 has some Iraqis asking, are we worse off than under Saddam? First news.
Check out KCRW's All News channel, News 24. Programming from KCRW, NPR, the BBC, and more, 24 hours a day. Check out kcrw.com/news24 or listen on KCRW's app.
Support for To the Point comes from the members of KCRW and from the Public Radio International Program Fund.
This is To the Point. I'm Barbara Bogave in for Warren Olney. Just ahead, 1 month to go until the Olympic Games, and Brazil is in a state of emergency. But it's not just political and economic crises. Athletes have been mugged at gunpoint. Venues are unfinished or perhaps unsafe. The Olympics mascot was shot dead. Can it get any worse? Later on today's Talking Point, Sunday's car bomb in Baghdad now has a death toll of 250, the bloodiest single day since 2003. Amid the long-awaited official inquiry into the British role in the Iraq War released today, some Iraqis are asking, are they worse off in 2016 than they were under Saddam Hussein? First, this news update. The videotape killing of a black man in Baton Rouge by police officers will be the focus of a civil rights investigation by the U.S. Justice Department. Authorities say that 37-year-old Alton Sterling had a gun as he wrestled with police on the pavement outside a convenience store. Police had responded to an anonymous caller who said a man selling homemade CDs was threatening someone with a gun outside the store. But a cell phone video of the Tuesday shooting doesn't appear to show a gun. Here's Baton Rouge Police Chief Carl Dabady today announcing the federal takeover of the case.
We are going to turn the entire case over to the U.S. Attorney's Office and the FBI to conduct the investigation from this point. We feel that it is in the best interest of the Baton Rouge Police Department, the city of Baton Rouge, and this community for this to happen.
Melinda Delatt is a Baton Rouge correspondent for the Associated Press and joins us now. Thanks very much.
Thank you for having me.
What reportedly happened at the scene in this case?
Well, so what we know so far is that 37-year-old Alton Sterling got into some sort of confrontation with police in front of this convenience store early in the morning after 4th of July. There was an anonymous caller who said he had been threatened by someone with a gun outside the store, and that's when police showed up. Mr. Sterling sold homemade CDs outside of that store. And was apparently a frequent figure at the store. There is a cell phone video that was taken by a community activist and posted online that shows two police officers pinning Mr. Sterling to the ground, and you can hear someone yell, he's got a gun, and then the gunfire starts. The U.S. Justice Department has opened a civil rights investigation into the killing. And that's kind of where things stand as of midday today.
Now, there are multiple video footage is of this encounter. A witness taped the encounter with police on an iPhone. There's also possibly dash cam, police body camera footage, according to police officials, and possibly surveillance footage. What do the videos show, or what do we know at this point?
Well, the Baton Rouge police haven't. They have confirmed that they have dash cam video, that they have some body camera video, and that they have store surveillance video. The body camera video, they say, may not be very good because what they claim is that the cameras on both police officers were dislodged during an altercation with Mr. Sterling, and that the body camera video was not very good. But they say they've turned over all of that video, the store surveillance video, the dash cam, and the body camera video, all to the U.S. Department of Justice since they are now taking the lead on this investigation. None of that video has been publicly released.
And here's Louisiana Governor John Bel Edwards today speaking about the video.
I will say that based on the information that I have obtained from law enforcement, but certainly the footage that I observed of the video that was made available, I have very serious concerns. The video is disturbing, to say the least.
And now, just to be clear, Louisiana is an open carry state. So just being armed isn't necessarily an issue if the person in question is not brandishing it.
That is correct. That is correct.
So, and the victim was a regular at the spot selling videos? What do we know about him?
That's what we know is he sells homemade CDs, and he is apparently regularly seen at this location. We are still kind of digging up whatever details we can find out about him. We do know that he had a son. His son was at a press conference this morning with the NAACP and some other community leaders. His son broke down at that press conference. I believe he's 15 years old. Very upset, obviously. But there have been lots of folks who have been interviewed who say that they didn't know Alton Sterling to be a violent man, and that they didn't have any difficult interactions with him, and that he was commonly seen at the store.
Now, with Alton Sterling's killing, more than 500 people have been killed by officers so far this year, and you've seen protests in the wake of this killing in Baton Rouge. How large a response has there been so far, and is there a sense that the protests can grow?
So far, the protest overnight had maxed out at around 200 people. It was a peaceful protest. There's a makeshift memorial at the convenience store, and there have been some minor protests around that location again. There is a vigil planned at the convenience store later today. I talked to some local African-American state legislators who represent the area, and they say they think that with the governor's involvement and coming out so quickly and having the investigation turned over to the Department of Justice fully, that they think that might diffuse any possibility that protests could become violent in any fashion.
And we'll end it there. Thanks so much, Melinda DeLotte, a Baton Rouge correspondent for the AP. Coming up, Zika, doping, crime, corruption, collapse, the making of Rio's 2016 Olympic Games. Stay with us for that conversation on To The Point from PRI.
This podcast is produced by nonprofit radio station KCRW. Support the podcast you enjoy by donating at kcrw.com/join. And thanks.
KCRW thanks Factiva from Dow Jones for its use of Factiva.com.
This is To The Point. I'm Barbara Bogave. A month until Brazil lights its Olympic cauldron in Rio, and the country is in a shambles. A month ago, Rio's state government declared a state of a calamity to access extra funding to pay for the games. Almost all venues are still under construction. In April, a newly built bike path along Rio's seashore collapsed, killing two people on the same day that the Olympic torch was lit in Greece. Drug traffickers are involved in territorial disputes in at least 20 Rio neighborhoods. A crime wave is sweeping the city, and body parts. Yes, body parts recently washed up on the beach where the volleyball competitions will be held. And we even haven't gotten to the mosquito-borne Zika epidemic or Russian athletes banned because of a doping scandal. Paulo Prada is senior correspondent for Reuters based in Rio de Janeiro, and he joins us now. Welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you for having me.
What are we to make of these games at this point, 1 month from the start?
Well, I think it's a question everybody, even here, is asking, because the Olympic Games, when they were awarded to Brazil about 8 years ago, were meant to showcase Brazil's arrival. It was, at the time, you know, headlong in an economic boom. Geopolitically, it was, you know, sort of advancing on the world stage. People who had long sort of seen Brazil as, you know, the country of the future thought that that was finally happening. But in the past, you know, 3 or 4 years, things have changed dramatically. There's been a historic corruption scandal, all sorts of political chaos. The president is now being impeached. Oil prices have plummeted, meaning that the local economy in Rio is basically broken, and the country itself is in a historic recession, the worst since the Great Depression. So the Olympics are certainly not the showcase that officials hoped it would be. And it's now turning out to be just another big event that plays out in Brazil against the backdrop of a lot of messiness, really.
And some of that messiness is some very serious crime. I just referenced a terrible crime wave in Rio, and I understand that a few days ago, armed men attacked a Rio hospital to bust out a drug kingpin, and also at least one Olympic athlete in Rio has already been robbed at gunpoint.
Right. Well, you know, street crime and violence are always an issue here, even at the best of times. And again, the local economy has gotten a lot worse. The state government, which is responsible for day-to-day security here, is bankrupt. So they've been paying police late, if at all. And so you're having a lot of backsliding in what had been some very real gains in terms of security in some of the poorer and more troubled neighborhoods in the city.
Police have said they might strike and apparently are meeting tourists outside the main airport with signs that read, "Welcome to Hell."
Right, yeah, that was a function of these delayed salary payments. The state government today is actually saying that they'll, by the end of the week, have caught up with all their payments for the salaries, because essentially the federal government had to step in and provide an injection of about 3 billion reais, which is, you know, a little less than $1 billion, to help them meet those salary needs and other security costs that they're going to endure for the next couple of months.
Well, the mood sounds grim, but is that the case for Brazilians? Are they at all looking forward to the Olympics?
You know,
as a distraction.
You wouldn't think that the Olympics are about to happen here. That said, you know, Brazilians are very used to big events. I mean, they've had the World Cup here 2 years ago. They have giant, you know, carnival and New Year's celebrations every year that in themselves, you know, mobilize more people, draw more tourists than the Olympics will. And so, you know, a lot of people just sort of see this as one other thing. But you know, the backdrop is one of concern because, you know, people think, well, you know, we'll probably pull this off somehow. People will have a good time, as they always do when they come to visit Brazil. But what's going to happen after the Games? So people are far more concerned about the long term and what is going to happen in terms of the economy, in terms of the political uncertainty, and certainly in terms of safety and security. Than they are about, you know, what's going to happen during the sports events.
Paulo Prado with Reuters, based in Rio. Let's bring in Jules Boykoff now. He's Pacific University professor who spent 5 months in Brazil as a Fulbright scholar studying Olympics preparations. And Boykoff is the author of Power Games, A Political History of the Olympics. And it's good of you to join us.
Thank you.
Now, you visited Guanabara Bay, where the sailing events will occur just this morning. It's legendarily polluted, and as part of its bid, Brazilian officials promised to clean it up. Tell us what you saw today.
That's right. I'm in Rio right now, and just today I went to a number of sites around Guanabara Bay, and the pollution is horrific. There's no getting around it. Guanabara Bay smells like an open sewer. In a way, it sort of is. Green soda bottles, plastic bags, carcasses of animals float atop this sort of brown, sludgy water. There was sort of a carpet of pollution, of water bottles and whatnot, sort of strangling these mangroves that I was walking through. And then, of course, below, what you can actually see lurks a sort of toxic cocktail of viruses and drug-resistant bacteria. And, you know, even outside of Guanabara Bay, a really important investigative report found that all five Olympic water venues are awash with sewage to a dangerous degree. So it's a real problem in Rio, and this was something that was supposed to be fixed by the Olympics. As you said, you know, in the Olympic bid, they made big promises about water. More specifically, they said that they would have 80% of the water flowing into places like Guanabara Bay get treated for sewage. And right now, that percentage is more like 20-21%.
Well, how does something like this compare? I mean, I've never heard of body parts washing ashore at beaches or super bacteria in Olympic waters. But I do have to ask you how these preparations compare to what other countries have gone through in the past.
Well, I would say in some ways they're extreme, like the water situation is horrific and extreme. In some ways, though, they actually resemble previous Olympics in particular ways. For example, there have been about 77,000 people who in Rio de Janeiro who have been displaced from their homes, evicted from their homes since Rio was awarded the Games back in 2009. And unfortunately, in a number of recent venues, this has been the case. For example, Beijing, who hosted the 2008 Olympics, they evicted 1.5 million people. London evicted only about 1,200 or so. So it continues that trend in a certain respect. There's also the overspending as well. That's definitely a trend in Olympic history recent times. It's almost like etch-a-sketch economics, where you sort of say one thing on the front end, oh, the Olympics are only going to cost so many billions of dollars, when later they cost many, many billion dollars more. You know, and here they were supposed to cost in the neighborhood of about $10 billion to start with, which is funny because a lot of people said, oh, you know, look at that. It's only $10 billion. It just shows how far the Olympics have come and the expectations for gigantism. But it's supposed to now, according to some credible economists, cost more like $20 billion. And that continues a trend. I mean, London was an extreme example of this. Originally, it was supposed to cost about $3.8 billion, and it ended up costing $18 billion. So, I mean, there are trends that you see at work here in Rio. Some of them are more extreme. You know, there's the Olympic Village that's being built that I could talk about as well, that is sort of an unvarnished example of sort of elite privilege in the city that unfortunately is kind of par for the course when it comes to the Olympics.
I'm also thinking of Sochi, Russia's Winter Games in 2014. The infrastructure, new hotel rooms didn't have plumbing, and police were rounding up and shooting stray dogs just as the games were beginning. And also Beijing, with a terrific smog problem, seems to. The pollution issues seem to call that back up.
Yeah, no, that's another really good recent historical example. I mean, the Sochi Olympics were originally supposed to cost $10 billion. In the end, they cost more than $50 billion. That's more than all the previous Olympics combined. And because they decided to site those Olympics in essentially what was a political tinderbox, they had to surround all the area around Sochi with police and security officials in tents. And, you know, that's another one of the trends that I didn't mention, is that there will be 85,000 security officials on hand here in Rio to police the games. That's double the number that we saw in London. And it was a heavily policed London Games as well. So one thing that's kind of alarming for people here in Rio, some of them I've talked to recently, is, you know, are they making Brazil or Rio into a terrorist target? After all, there is no history of terrorism, thank goodness, here in Rio or in Brazil. They said as much in the bid when they were pitching it and trying to make Rio sound like a positive place to host the games. But unfortunately, because the games have become so big, they've become a terrorist target. You just need to look at Munich, 1972. There was a bomb that went off in Atlanta in 1996. And those Sochi games that you mentioned, they were explicitly targeted by a Chechen rebel called Doku Umarov. So, you know, that's a real concern for people here as well.
Well, I wonder, you've talked to a lot of people about the Olympics. Are more and more people asking whether the games are worth this human and financial cost?
Well, as you said, I lived here from August through December last year, and it was really hard to find somebody then who was at all excited about the Olympics. And I thought maybe when I came back this week that I might be a little easier, but it's quite difficult. I mean, there is a sort of ho-hum about it, kind of get it over with and we need to move on here. I went to a protest last night, an anti-Olympics protest, where a lot of people were raising big questions about spending and, you know, the choices and priorities that these spending indicate for the city. So, you know, you're spending billions on the Olympics. Meanwhile, these hospitals are being shuttered. As you mentioned, the police aren't being paid on time. They're lacking basics like, you know, toilet paper and paper for their facilities. So, yeah, the protest last night, a rambunctious group of about 300 or 400 people were raising these kind of questions in a pretty loud way.
Let's bring in Paulo Sotero. He's director of the Brazil Institute at the Wilson Center, and he was previously Washington correspondent for O Estado de São Paulo, Brazil's second largest newspaper. It's good to talk with you today.
Pleasure to be with you, Barbara, although to talk about this that has become obviously pretty much a nightmare for Brazilian officials and for the people. People are simply not psychologically there in terms of the game.
And that's what we're hearing. And even the mayor of Rio is saying that preparations are terrible. But where do you put the blame? Is this bad timing, bad luck, a certain measure of the blight, the difficulties that always attend the Olympics?
This is not bad luck. This was, as a colleague of ours recently wrote in the New York Times, this is a man-made disaster. We had enough time to prepare for this, and we did not. Authorities did not do what they are supposed to do. At the same time, we knew that members of the party, PMDB, party of the mayor of Rio, part of the government of Rio, and the party that governing coalition with the Workers' Party, governed Brazil, they really were involved in some huge corruption scandals that are now being investigated. This is the only silver lining of the whole situation, is that we are moving forward on the rule of law business. But as far as the Olympics, this is a collective failure. If you ask Brazilians today, should we host the Olympics, they will tell you, no, we are not interested. And as was just said, you know, they want this to go through. People will, I assume, be well received in Rio. Let's hope that there is no terrorist attempt in Rio. The violence, the garden variety violence that we have in Rio is already enough of a source of concern. But, you know, expectations are so low that we may, in the end, have a little bit what happened in the World Cup. You know, people say, oh, this is going to be a nightmare. In the end, the only nightmare was the soccer part, because the event itself was praised by all the foreign visitors. I assume there will be much less foreign visitors than the authorities there prepared for,
because of all of Zika and also the news about crime. But people have a way of embracing the Olympics, of grumbling about it before it comes, and Brazilians have more reason perhaps than many, but then embracing it when it does come. Do you anticipate we'll feel any of these sentiments that Brazilians are feeling, a resentment of the Games, though, at the opening ceremonies, say?
Oh, yes. Yes, certainly the president will be there. He'll be soundly booed, and the mayor will be soundly booed at the end in the closing ceremony, but the mayor himself said that. Now, you know, never underestimate the capacity of Brazilians also to throw a party. We tend to be a very nice group of people. So I believe that during the period of the Olympics, there will be enough of a party atmosphere. It's not difficult to put a security bubble sort of in Rio for 15 days and make things work. And then, you know, after the game, there will be many stories during the game of, you know, people overcoming difficulties, etc. I mean, the sports events, and people will be concentrating and celebrating that. After all, it will be a break in all the bad news that Brazil has produced. People outside of Rio are really not even concentrated on this. I don't know a single Brazilian person from outside of Rio that is even interested, you know, or going, etc. But
well, we're interested. We're going to talk more about it in the second half of the show. And let's take a break now, and then we'll be back with more of our Olympics preview, whether Brazil will benefit at all from the high cost of these games in the midst of this economic and political crisis, and a look at what this event is about, the athletes, who to watch, who's close up and up close and personal story is worth the airtime. That's later on To the Point from PRI.
Check out KCRW's music blog for song premieres, music news, performances, and KCRW DJ features. Stay up to date on all of KCRW's music happenings at kcrw.com/musicblog.
This is To The Point. I'm Barbara Bogave in for Warren Olney, and we're back with our Olympics preview. We've been talking about the many challenges Rio faces in getting these games up and running, with Brazil facing a political and economic crisis. But there are a lot of really talented, exciting athletes braving the Zika mosquito-borne virus endemic in Brazil and heading to Rio, and they're going to face their own issues, including the possible ban on Russian athletes because of the recent doping scandal and fallout from the criminal corruption case against the IOC. Alan Abrahamson is founder and columnist of Three Wire Sports. It's a blog about the Olympic movement and international sports, and he's chief columnist for NBCOlympics.com. Welcome to the show.
Hi. I can, you know, listening to everybody, I'm so excited now to go to Brazil for my ninth Olympics.
I know. This is a little, well, I mean, there's some very serious problems that I don't want to make light of, but this has been a bit of a downer as Olympic shows go. And now we're going straight to doping. The International Association of Athletics Federation suspended Russia in November after a World Anti-Doping Agency report that showed widespread and state-sponsored doping in Russian track and field. But Russia has appealed the ban. So where does that stand now? And what do you think will happen? Will Russia be at the Olympics?
Well, that's the $64,000, or in Russia's case, $51 billion question. Right now, the ban is in place. The Russians are appealing, saying it's unfair. And to be honest, I think it's unfair, too. Here's why I think it's unfair.
Wait a minute. We are talking about the same doping scandal that involved people passing vials of urine through a hole in a wall.
Okay, so those are fantastic allegations. Serious, damning, compelling allegations.
Certainly vivid.
Awesome, vivid. But the problem is that right now those are only allegations. And the concern that I have, and I think the concern that any fair-minded person would have, is that you can't be making collective adjudications when what's at issue is individual responsibility. And none of these allegations, though very, very serious indeed, have been tested at any formal setting. There hasn't been any cross-examination. There hasn't been any chance to test any of this. And it just violates, you know, norms and standards to say to a whole bunch of people, you can't go because so-and-so did such-and-such. I mean, for instance, excuse me, the two biggest cheaters arguably in Olympic or international sports history are Marion Jones and Lance Armstrong. Did anyone say that the American track and field team should be banned because of Marion Jones, or that the American cycling team should be banned because of Lance Armstrong? No. So for me, what's at issue is a visceral, and to use your word again, vivid, dislike, hatred, fear, whatever word you want, of Mr. Putin.
Well, let's bring Jules Boykoff back into the conversation. Jules Boykoff, you are our Olympics expert and the history of the Olympics. Where do you fit this Russian doping scandal into the span of the history of the Games?
Sure. Well, there have long been allegations against athletes throughout the history of the Games. Think no further than the East German athletes of yore. But this is a little different in the sense that it's so focused on one country, and the allegations that these are practices that were bricked into the way that Russia actually tested their athletes, and that there was corruption across the board. And I think that's why you're seeing that penalty, because this is a unique sort of moment. I think that
that was the case with the East German Olympic preparations
really
as well.
We really didn't find out about the specifics of that until much later after it happened. What's different about this case is that it's happening in real time. You've got athletes that have been nabbed for missing tests and not passing tests. So, you know, there is a historical difference there, but I think there is a strong argument to be made that this is collective punishment against a group of people, many of whom maybe haven't actually cheated. But the problem is that the system in which they were operating does appear to be cheating, and that there's pretty strong evidence of that.
And back to you, Alan Abrahamson. This is the debate that we always have when we talk about doping. Either finally you come down with a ban like this and you get a very punitive, or Or you level the playing field. I mean, everyone is doing it, so why not let them?
Well, the last one is not an option. You just can't let this become the WWE. That's not what the Olympics is or is about. One of the other problems with leveling a ban against the Russians is if we, the collective we, are going to ban the Russians, then how about our friends in Kenya? Or if I look at the WADA statistics for how many doping tests there were in Jamaica in 2012 before the London Olympics, it's very hard to find any credibility in their anti-doping program. The real problem is this. People, especially before an edition of the Olympics, whether winter or summer, like to say, oh, doping is bad, bad, bad. And it is. I want to be clear about that. You know, it's bad. But if we globally are going to do something about this, we have to find a way to fund the anti-doping campaign. Right now, the World Anti-Doping Agency's budget is $26 million. That's $26 million. Just to give you an idea of the scale, Ohio State's annual athletic department budget is $150 million. So we can whine and complain and do everything all we want, but we're really not serious about it.
Well, I want to close this doping chapter for the time being just with one more question. How is it likely to affect these games and the performance-enhancing drug tests that athletes always do undergo?
Well, as I always like to say, if you test positive at the Olympic Games for doping, you are an idiot. The time to use performance-enhancing drugs is in the off-season. I mean, you have to be really compellingly stupid to test positive at the Games because you know they're going to be testing. As far as how this is going to affect these Games, if the Russians are not there, then I would expect other countries to do exceptionally well in certain sports, and in particular the United States. I mean, the Russian track team is very good.
Okay, let's talk sports then. What should people be watching for? And, of course, Simone Biles, is an American gymnast, and she's really charmed and amazed millions of Americans already.
Yeah, so for an American audience, the first week of the Games is all about swimming and gymnastics. And Simone Biles has won 3 straight world championships, and she's a gymnast who's going to probably be famous, one word famous, like Nadia or Olga. She's that good. And what you see when you watch her is not someone who's afraid of making mistakes, but someone who embraces exuberantly the fear of flying. It's a wonderful thing to see. In swimming, Michael Phelps is back for his 5th Olympics, and he looks pretty darn good after having just been at the swim trials. I have to tell you, he looks good.
Really?
Yeah.
And how about Katie Ledecky?
And Katie Ledecky is going to set the world on fire in Rio. Not since Debbie Mayer at the 1968 Olympics has anyone won the 2, 4, and 800 freestyles. And you could you could bet your mortgage that Katie Ledecky will win all 3 of those events.
And getting back to Paulo Prada, senior correspondent for Reuters based in Rio, are the Brazilian athletes, the Olympians themselves, excited for the Games? We talked a lot about the public, but not about them.
Well, some of them are, yes. I mean, it's the Olympics, you know, on their home turf. So for them as athletes, it's very exciting. But, you know, there are also some who, as Brazilians, are also just as concerned about the many problems facing the city and their country as, you know, people who have nothing to do with the sports or the events. So for many of them, it's a mixed feeling. But, you know, during the event itself, you can bet that they will, you know, be focused on what they do, and that's the sports.
And getting back to sports with Alan Abrahamson, we have golf and rugby new at these Games, but golf seems to be a bust because of Zika dropouts, right? What is it with the golfers?
Yeah, well, exactly. What is it with the golfers? Some of the top names in men's golf have pulled out saying, oh, Zika, or this doesn't fit my schedule, or whatever. So if you like Olympic golf, enjoy it now, because you're going to see it in 2016. They're guaranteed to be in for Tokyo in 2020, and then they will be slam-bang gone. I mean, that's not the way the Olympic Committee likes its athletes to respond.
And rugby? It's such an exciting sport to watch. Are people thinking this might stick?
Yeah, rugby is a different animal. So the Olympic version of rugby is called rugby sevens, as opposed to 15, and it's a made-for-TV sport. It lasts a half hour. It's super fast. And you could win a great bar bet by asking who was the last men's team to win Olympic gold in rugby. That would be the United States in 1924.
1924. Well, we'll see. How do they look now?
They have a couple really good players, but one of the reasons they brought rugby into the games was to give countries like Fiji and Samoa legitimately a chance to win a gold medal.
And we were talking about Zika. What effect has it had, the crisis or the epidemic in Brazil, had on these games, besides the golf players, the golfers who weren't going to show up? How many athletes might not come?
I'd say about none, at least on the American side. You have to remember that Olympic athletes are by nature different than the rest of us mortals. These are hyper-competitive people. They work 4 years for a race that lasts, let's say 2 minutes or less. They will be there.
We're always interested in the U.S. track team's record, and Usain Bolt of Jamaica is a favorite as well in track. I understand he's injured, though, right?
Yeah, so he pulled out of the Jamaican trials last week with a slight hamstring tear. Everyone expects Usain to be in Rio. The question is what kind of shape he's going to be in. Justin Gatlin won the trials here in Eugene on Sunday in a 9.8. That's pretty fast. Allison Felix looks fantastic. LaShawn Merritt, who also runs the 400, looks fantastic. And I'm really, really hoping, both personally and professionally, that Ashton Eaton, who's the American decathlon champion, gets a lot of airtime and a lot of love from the American people. He is the kind of young man that every mom and dad would want their young person to grow up to be.
How so?
You know, he wins, and beyond that, he's humble, he's intelligent, he's eloquent, and he's just a great young guy.
Alan Abrahamson, founder of Three Wire Sports and also the chief columnist for NBCOlympics.com. Turning back to you, Paulo Sotera, director of the Brazil Institute at the Wilson Center, it's always a question how much money a host country and a host city can recoup from the Olympics. What do you imagine? How will it shake out with Rio?
Oh, very poorly, probably. I think that this will be very much scrutinized by the Brazilian media, by Brazilian tribunals, etc., because of the ongoing corruption scandal in Brazil. Anything and everything that involves expenditure of public money in major events in Brazil or major companies is under scrutiny. I don't think there is much is expected in terms of a return of a financial return. Let's hope that some of the infrastructure that is being put there, actually there is one metro line that is being finished as we speak, may add something to the city, to the city's infrastructure, to the quality of life, the population. Those are the things that can have impacts down the line. I think the renewal of Rio, there are major works ongoing that are very good on paper. They have started. I think a lot of those things won't be finished on time. But, at some point they will be finished. Rio will continue to be one of the most beautiful urban cities in the world, and some benefits may come from that. But I think the memory of the positive memory of the Rio Olympics will really depend on the achievements of athletes. I think that certainly there will be good stories there, as we just heard. As far as Brazilians, I think normally it is expected the hosting country increases substantially the number of Olympic medals it receives. It's not clear that Brazil will be able to do that.
There are so many questions up in the air. Paulo Sotera, director of the Brazil Institute at the Wilson Center, and back to you with one of them, Jules Boykoff. All problems aside, are you confident that Brazil and Rio can make the Olympics not only happen, but a winning games, a winning spectacle?
Well, I think we need to set the bar pretty low. Just get the venues done, get people to safely from place to place, and that would be an achievement in itself. And in a weird way, that, me thinking all too much about that question is sort of evidence that, there are bigger issues that affect everyday people in this city. And that, you know, when I start thinking, and I always do, about Olympic athletes and how will the polluted water affect them, or perhaps Zika, how might that affect them, I have to put myself in check and say, okay, well, what kind of harm does these things impose on the everyday people of Rio? You know, for them, water is a long-term health catastrophe. For them, the fact that mosquitoes can breed easily here is another long-term health catastrophe. So, you know, can the Rio Olympics be ready? Well, let's hope so. You know, they're really cutting that Linea Quattro that Paulo mentioned here, the extension of the metro line, down to the very last minute. They're saying it's going to open on August 1st, and the Olympics, of course, open on August 5th, so there's not a lot of room for error there. And I agree, that could possibly be a positive legacy for the people of Rio, in particular for Jocinho, which is one of the biggest favela of Rio, and there's a stop nearby. But besides the extension of the metro line, I think the actual positive legacies for the everyday people of Rio are pretty slim pickings.
I want to thank all of you. We're gonna bring a stop to our conversation right now. I want to thank you for joining me, though. You were just listening to Jules Boykoff. He's political science professor at Pacific University in Oregon. Also joining us, Paulo Prada, senior correspondent for Reuters based in Rio. Paulo Sotera, director of the Brazil Institute at the Wilson Center. And Alan Abrahamson, chief columnist for NBCOlympics.com. Thanks so much for taking the time. Just ahead, the deadliest attack in Baghdad since 2003 has some Iraqis asking, are we worse off than under Saddam Hussein? Back in a moment with that on today's Talking Point. This is To the Point from PRI.
Select sessions from KCRW's music program, Morning Becomes Eclectic, can be experienced in the immersive world of virtual reality. Download KCRW's VR app to get lost in the music. Go to kcrw.com/VR.
I'm Barbara Bogave here with today's Talking Point. Among the recent spate of terror attacks, the explosions that rocked Baghdad on Sunday were the deadliest by far. The death toll stands at 250, the highest number for a single attack there since 2003 when the U.S. invaded. ISIS has claimed responsibility, saying it was targeting Shiites, but the shopping district site was a multicultural hub featuring both Shiite and Sunni mosques. All the victims were Iraqis, some of them children, and Iraqis have expressed frustration that the world is less concerned with them than the victims of other recent attacks. Pray for Iraq is now trending on Twitter. Zayd Al-Ali is the author of The Struggle for Iraq's Future, and it's good of you to join me.
Thanks for having me.
What are we hearing from Iraqis themselves in the wake of this attack?
Well, I mean, Iraqis are obviously very, very frustrated, and that was best articulated by the fact that when the current prime minister visited the site of the attack the day after it took place, around about 12 hours after it took place, his convoy of vehicles was pelted with stones and he attacked by observers, by Iraqi citizens who happened to be around at the time. There are lots of videos up on YouTube and on Facebook that you can watch to see how he was chased out of the neighborhood. And they used all sorts of expletives to refer to him as well. People are very, very upset, not just the prime minister, of course. He gets a lot of the blame just because he happens to be the prime minister, but it's against the whole political class and the political system that allows for the type of political system that has allowed for the most intense terrorist campaign against any country in the history of the world. You have to remember that these terrorist attacks have been going on now for 13 years. It's been unrelenting, and it's really unprecedented in the whole history of the world. And Iraqis have really borne the brunt of it, and they blame, obviously, the terrorists, but they also blame the politicians who are running the state and who have been completely incapable of keeping people safe. And they've made that very, very clear in all the statements that they've made to the press and their writings and the way they treat their politicians.
And help us understand that. They hold the state responsible for why so many died, and how so?
Yeah, so for different reasons. So some of your listeners may know that the vast majority of the people that died during the explosion or after the explosion on Saturday night didn't die as a result of the explosion. They died as a result of the fact that the building that was targeted by the explosion didn't have any safety measures inbuilt when they constructed the building. So there was no fire escape, there were no sprinklers, there was no way out for the people, and so basically most of the people died as a result of the flames that engulfed the building afterwards or because of asphyxiation. And that's because of an uncaring state that does nothing to make sure that building regulations are enforced. And the second reason why people blame the state is because security measures around Baghdad are a complete joke. Anyone who's been around Baghdad can see that for their own eyes. And the way you can know that is because in Baghdad, security forces still use a bogus, completely farcical, and fake bomb detector as their principal method to detect explosives. It's a silly plastic device with an antenna on it, which is supposed to point to vehicles when there's an explosive in it, and it functions on the same basis as dowsing. I don't know if that's a common concept in the United States or not, but it's bogus. There's no technology involved. It's been proven to be bogus, and the owner of the company who sold these things to the Iraqi government is a former British police officer whose name is Jim McCormick, who was sent to jail in the United Kingdom in 2013, and he was given the maximum penalty for fraud by the Old Bailey, which is a high court in London, and he was given 10 years for fraud. And everyone in Iraq knows that. Everyone knows that this individual is now in jail and has been in jail for years now, and that the devices are fraudulent, but they can see that the security forces are still using them. Not because the individual police officers and the army think that they work. The reason why they're told to use them is because they're forced to, because their instructions tell them they have to use them. And they're forced to use them by the politicians who run the state. And the reason why the politicians forced them to use it is because the politicians were involved in the purchasing of this equipment. They know that it's fraudulent, but they just don't care. They prefer to keep up the facade, the farce, that this thing works, rather than admit that they've been using this bogus stuff to theoretically keep people safe over the past few years.
Right. Security theater, which we're familiar with in the U.S. Robin Wright is senior fellow at the U.S. Institute for Peace and the Woodrow Wilson Center and a contributor to The New Yorker, and she joins us as well. Thanks for taking part in the conversation.
Great to be with you.
Help us understand the broader political situation then in Iraq today, not only as regards the security theater and their attitude towards the Iraqi government, but whether repeated crises are moving towards splintering the country.
Well, the real danger is that 13 years after the U.S. intervention, there has not been any basic political solution to the question, the fundamental question of how do you share power in a country with diverse and often divisive ethnic and sectarian groups? How do you share the oil wealth among groups whose differences have only been exacerbated since the U.S. intervention? And a succession of governments have been unable to forge some kind of agreement in parliament that would, whether it's some kind of federal arrangement, whether it's the devolution of power to the provinces, they haven't been able to find these solutions. And as a result, the differences among people have exacerbated, opened the way for ISIS to emerge and sweep through the country, and that even if there's a military pushback against ISIS, you still don't have the fundamentals needed to ensure that people feel invested in the future of Iraq in the way they have been for the past century. And so all of this, the bombing was symptomatic of the much broader problems in Iraq today and the question of can it hold together in the chaos of that particular part of the region today.
And you're talking about the broad picture of Iraq today. Now, also today, the UK came out with the Chilcot Report, which is a broad indictment of how Britain entered into the Iraq War from very long ago. And it's refocusing the world on this decision to go to the war in the first place. It's a damning indictment of Tony Blair's leadership, of British involvement. And it stands in contrast to, of course, where Iraqis feel they are now. What do you think the takeaway is from this huge report so far and what it possibly means to people in the Middle East who are living out the reality of this so many years later?
Well, this report is damning not just for Britain. It's really damning for any government that was involved in the intervention in Iraq. The report took 7 years to produce, longer than Britain's involvement in combat in Iraq. It's four times longer than War and Peace, the epic novel, and it is scathing in its criticism, charging that the government of Tony Blair failed to challenge or even examine carefully the charges of whether Saddam Hussein had an active weapons of mass destruction program, that the intelligence was flawed, that there was an inadequate preparation for the conflict. There was a shaky legal rationale, that it was flawed in its attempts to win international cooperation or even UN approval, and that there's almost nothing positive to come out of this report, and Tony Blair is portrayed basically as succumbing to his American allies and never once really challenging the Bush administration on its intervention. In terms of its impact in the region, I think it will deeply frustrate Iraqis. I mean, can you imagine having lived through 13 years of chaos and then having a report come out and say that the presumption was all wrong and this was a mistake in many ways, and Iraqis are the ones who have paid the largest price for it.
And just very briefly, back to you, Zayd Al-Ali. We saw on the BBC a man who was famous for toppling the statue of Saddam Hussein, and he had lost relatives, many, to the regime. He'd served a year and a half in prison, and he said he wishes Saddam had never been deposed. Do you hear this from other Iraqis?
Yeah, sure. You do hear it a lot, but it doesn't necessarily mean that they mean it. You know, there's a lot of nostalgia for the past in many countries around the world. There's even a nostalgia for East Germany and parts of Germany. You know, people talk about those sorts of things and they make statements, but they don't necessarily really mean that they want to go back to the way things were. But it does go to a certain feeling of frustration towards the current situation. They had no expectation that things would turn out as badly as they are today. And so therefore, it's normal that a lot of people try to reminisce about some fantasized version of the past as being, you know, being ideal. But in terms of the Chilcot report, I must say that I don't think it's going to have any impact on the psyche of ordinary Iraqis. I mean, they couldn't care less what, you know, what people think about Tony Blair back in the United Kingdom and so on. They have far, far more important things to worry about.
And on that, I think we'll have to end it, but I want to thank you, Zayd Al-Ali. Also, Robin Wright joined us. Thank you so much for taking the time. And all of you, do join us again for To the Point, produced live and podcast as a co-production of KCRW Santa Monica and Public Radio International.
PRI, Public Radio International.